Good Thursday morning. My name is Mark Frowell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. How are you feeling today? I'm feeling darn good. Great weekend. The humidity has dissipated in the tri-state area. Thank God. Whew. I couldn't even escape in my basement. The subways were insufferable. Unbelievable show coming your way. We're going to meet an athlete who's headed to Rio, Rio bound. Will Lackenauer is a member of the U.S. Paralympic National Cycling Team and a hell of a guy. He's got a great story. Before Will's accident, he skied, water skied, climbed, mountain biked competitively, and then everything changed after his accident, which made him become a Paralympic hand cycling elite athlete. And I had the great pleasure of meeting him recently. And as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, every week leading up to the Paralympics in September, we're going to have a different athlete on, because not only are these people incredible, not enough is known about Paralympians, because obviously all the interest is on the Olympics, which is always the first games, and the Paralympics always follow. And that's also another topic we're going to get into, because I think certainly it's really, really a compelling event and should be first. And also for many reasons, but not only because people will really enjoy them, but it's also just a great ramping up time for host countries. You know, when they get, you know, hundreds of thousands of people there for the Olympics, the Paralympics isn't nearly as gargantuan and doesn't draw as many people, unfortunately, but it's a great way for them to have like a soft launch to make sure everything works, especially with Rio and a lot of other countries in the past that really aren't doing the best job in terms of preparations, especially with the virus going around there, et cetera. I think Rio has finally got their act together, but I'm sure they're busy scampering around till the very last moment. I mean, it's a big endeavor hosting the Olympics. And got a lot of other interesting things to talk about. And one of the things I wanted to mention to you this weekend, this morning, happened to me over the weekend. And I'm sure a lot of these ring true for you, because in the world we live in, things are either really small or big. Obviously, I have the new iPhone 6SC, something like that. Sounds very code-like, right? James Bond. And I was taking my wife out for her early birthday dinner on Saturday. Today's her birthday. Happy birthday, pretty. Yay! And I was reminded about how bad my vision is when I cracked open a menu. Of course, the font is amazingly small. How many times you go into a restaurant? Now, I'm not talking about a restaurant that has the menus on the walls or pictures on the menus, because usually those are easy to see and they're much brighter, the restaurants. But when you go into a restaurant that's, you know, an average restaurant, or it's a nice restaurant, I swear the more expensive it is, the smaller the font is. Maybe because they don't want people to actually see how much an entree costs. Of course, the special's not on there, because we all know we get ripped off when we ask or want to order the special, because dare we ask how much the special is in front of everybody else. So I'm trying to read the menu. I break out my magnifier. It's still not good enough. And thankfully, my wife's like, you know, I can't read this. And the people next to me are like, oh, we couldn't read it either. And now we're talking about people who are in their 30s. Etc. So I don't know what it is. So I address the people, the menu gods of the world. Listen, do yourself a favor. Make it bigger. You can make the prices smaller if you want, but make it easier. You see people whipping out their iPhones with their flashlights and their magnifiers, because we're not talking baby boomers here. We're talking people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. They just can't be read. So the biggest thing that I have a problem with, I'd say consistently, besides restaurants, is when I go traveling. Try to read the name of the little bottles in the hotel rooms, whether they say shampoo, conditioner, or body wash. Most times, before I got clever and realized that I should line them up inside the shower, not because I have OCD. Well, I do, but that's another topic, just because I can't see. So, you know, these bottles are small enough as it is. So, you know, shampoo or cream rinse, you know, my God, it's unbelievable. So it's really funny. I've gotten a kick out of it many times when I've been using cream rinse inadvertently, thinking it's shampoo. So that's a big commonly possible faux pas that I make all the time, especially when you go over a friend's house and, you know, you're in the shower and you forgot to check. I'm like, and I have this, my sister-in-law must have 15 bottles in her shower. I kid you not. And I don't know what they all stand for because sometimes the font, you know, the name, of course, is really big, but what it actually is small. So I'm not going to be bringing my magnifier in the shower. I mean, walking into the bathroom with a magnifier could be really misinterpreted. You know what I'm saying? So usually yeah, somebody be like, all right, which one's the shampoo bottle? What color is it? All right, so that's all I need. But you got to line them up. But when you got like 15 bottles in there, I guess you have to protect the color of your hair if you're dying it, if you're a woman, like all these different. Man, it's tough being visually impaired. But it's nowhere in comparison being tough as being a woman, a role of a woman. Man, there's a lot. All right, so in the car. You're saying, oh, well, if you have problems seeing in a car, you shouldn't be driving, Mark, right? Well, what happens is, you know, I have a pair of glasses I wear like a dentist wears or a surgeon like telescopic devices. I mentioned this a while ago because I saw it on a commercial. There's an app that works extremely well, just as good as your speedometer in your car because it's using GPS, just like when you're trying to you're going on vacation or to point B and you put it in and it tells you how long it's going to take for you to get there. Because it's using GPS to mathematically calculate the distance of the trip based on the mileage and speed of your car. So my speedometer is analog, meaning that it's the dial. Okay, so a lot of new cars have digital readouts, but some of them, I'd say majority of them still have analog ones where it's just a needle pointing to the numbers. So I found this app that actually, you know, makes the font on your phone extremely big and it displays your miles per hour, which is totally cool. I saw it on a car commercial. I'm like, wow, let me try it. And it works extremely well. Totally accurate. Only thing is there's a lag period of like maybe half a second, which is nothing. You know, maybe you could fight that in court when you get a speeding ticket. But anyway, that has really, really improved my world because I have this large screen, as I just mentioned to you, the newest Apple. And it is really big. I love it. I love it. So it really has made my world much, much easier. The other thing is nutritional information. Wouldn't it be nice? Okay, I'm visually impaired, but, you know, for the most intents and purposes, I get around. I don't bump into walls. I don't have any problems. But, you know, you're trying to stay up on things, how much fat content there is, stay away from foreign substances that are made in labs like what's that one that's in Splenda and all those other things? Oh, my God, I just forgot the name of it. Anyway, it's in a lot of different things. Bad sugars, man-made sugars. We want to stay away from those. But reading labels is increasingly difficult, challenging, because the font is too damn small. You know, unbelievable. So it's a trying, ongoing fight. I think the FDA actually passed something that in maybe 2017 or 2019, something along the lines with the size of the font has to be proportionate to the size of the container, which they actually did for cigarettes a couple years ago. Because if you see ads, big ads, the warnings are really big, which makes sense. The other thing is when I'm in the gym, this is really kind of funny because I can't see the numbers on the plates. Now, I'm not talking about the free weight plates because I just know by the size of them, it's 10, 15, 25, 35, 45. And the dumbbells are pretty easy to read. But the actual machines where you put the pins in, they're small. So what I do is when I'm moving the pin down, I kind of know pretty much by, you know, it's 3/4 way through the stack on one machine, maybe half, or maybe actually on one body part, I'm really strong. I can go all the way to the bottom. But when I move it down, I put my hand on the next hole where the pin would go. Hey, get your mind out of the gutter now. And then I can just slide the pin in. Okay, keep it clean now. Keep it G. So that's one of the things that's kind of funny. And also, cologne. Now, there's two reasons why I bring up cologne, and it could be for perfume as well, but I don't wear perfume. I wear cologne. The names on the bottles are increasingly small, and not only that, but they have different terminology. So forget about if you're visually impaired or not. You have to be like a master in the scent industry because some of them say cologne, some of them say aftershave, some of them say shower mist or something like that. And there's like a few other terms. So you almost need a dictionary or Google at your disposal to find out what you can buy right away. Because in my world, cologne is cologne. That's what you wear. I don't want aftershave. I don't even, you know, I don't even shave enough to even wear aftershave. So it's kind of funny. Not only is the font small, but you need a dictionary, Wikipedia, to actually find out, you know, what you want to wear. It's pretty funny. So also, I wanted to mention to you that being visually impaired, and if you're not even, when you use a smartphone, this has bothered me for a while. You know how some sites that you bring up, you can easily make big? Now, you can have a Galaxy, iPhone, or whatever the case may be, and this applies to everybody. But you can't make the screen or the font or pictures any bigger. So I finally discovered a way, and this is extremely helpful, to enlarge whatever you're reading or looking at. So if you go to the bottom of your screen and you tap the bottom, there's an icon that gives you a lot of different things, a bookmark, save, copy, etc. There's also one that says use desktop site. Use desktop site. So that's pretty cool. Once it goes to that, you hit that icon and it actually goes to a different image, very similar to the one you're looking at on your smartphone, but this one enables you to make it bigger. How cool is that? I love that because there's so many different sites that I use that before I found this feature were really, really difficult for me to enlarge. So I was kind of bummed out because, you know, if I'm on the bus, I'm using my magnifying reading glasses and I had to whip out my, hey, easy now. I had to whip out my pocket magnifier and it was still difficult for me to see. But now when you go to this icon, it says use desktop site. That's very, very cool. So I mentioned to you just a few minutes ago, we're going to hear from Will Lackenauer, an incredible member of the U.S. Paralympic national cycling team. Great guy, too. Really, really great guy. His mantra is, this is what he says, quote, I plan on winning a Paralympic gold medal at the 2016 Rio Games, end quote. This guy is driven. He is just a super guy through and through. Husband, parent, small business owner, recognized in the community, and he suffered a break in his spine. And we're going to talk to him momentarily. But if you're into the Olympics at all, I urge you to continue listening today and every day leading up to the Olympics and Paralympics, because we're going to have a guest on in various different sports to talk about how incredible the Olympics are and Paralympics are. So have you heard about this? Now, I was never a big user of computers or games growing up. Just because, I guess, having bad eyes just never really drew me into it. Actually, my favorite game to this day is still Galaga. I love Galaga. Pac-Man, pretty cool. Nothing on this planet Earth kind of connects with me like Galaga does. The sounds, the visuals, you know what I'm talking about if you're a gamer. Even if you're not a gamer, I'm far, far, far from being a gamer. But anyway, I'm sure you read about this. Pokemon Go was released last week and in the States a couple days ago. And there's a picture in the paper the other day of only like when in this world that we live in right now, when everyone glued to their smartphone, where people are actually physically bumping into people because, you know, the app actually uses your GPS and your camera to help you navigate, walk around to play the game and interact and catch Pokemon, which, you know, is integrated into the real world, quote unquote, view of your cell phone app. So it actually reminds me of a story when I was at Starbucks in the city about a year ago. I don't usually go to Starbucks too often. If I do, it would never be like in morning rush hour because it's just, you know, swamped with people. But this was like an incredible, this is a sidebar here to the story. This was like an incredible social experiment because I was there. I ordered my tea, not a coffee drinker. Love the smell of it. Can't drink it. So I ordered my tea. And I'm watching all these people waiting for their drinks or whatever they ordered, food. And I mean, there was probably 20 or 30 of them. But the hysterical part was they all looked like penguins, all huddled together, because nobody, and I mean nobody, was looking up. They all had their bags around their shoulders because it's New York City. It's a walking city. And their briefcases or whatever. And pocketbooks, and they're all looking down. So when one person gets their order, double mocha chai, whatever, and plain bagel, whatever, so they waddle, like one person pushes through the sea, people hardly looking up, and no one is annoyed by this because the sea just gets parted. by this person walking with their smartphone as they go to get their order. And I thought this was hysterical, but also like sad commentary of like who we are nowadays, because we can't even like interact or maybe have a conversation with somebody waiting for your cup of coffee, that we have to have our nose buried. And it made me obviously think of this because of Pokemon Go being released. And in Central Park the other day, the picture in the newspaper of all these people just walking into each other. And in Central Park on a good day without people looking down at their computer playing Pokemon Go, it is really dangerous. People have gotten killed by bicyclists. And I'm one of those cyclists that, you know, goes, you know, balls fast through there. And so you got more and more people who are looking down at their damn palms, they're going to get hurt, man. So, but here's the point I wanted to make. So check this out. And if you're a therapist, you better really pay attention to this because your business could be impacted by this. Listen to this. Research, or I should say news, it's too early to have research. News has been reporting because people are actually posting on social websites that they have not left their house or have great difficulty leaving their houses, like people who suffer from agoraphobia or people who are depressed and have a great deal of trouble going out of their house. Pokemon Go is luring them outside. I kid you not. Do you believe this? This is what it takes for people with mental illness on whatever degree to go outside their house because of a game. I cannot believe this. So whether medication is helping them to a certain extent or their friends' encouragement, family's encouragement, maybe their job. But no, what gets them outside the door? A game. Can you believe? You cannot make this stuff up. I cannot believe this. But you know what? I think it's very cool because whatever it takes somebody to get over maybe the fear of being outside, of interaction, human interaction, making eye contact with people, as long as it's not, you know, dangerous. Like in Wyoming, a teen stumbled upon actually a corpse, a dead man in Wyoming. Unbelievable. I swear it sounds like I'm making all this stuff up. You can Google everything I'm saying. I urge you to, because this is a fact-based show. It is. I'm kidding you. And you can call me up and give me your input. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Say, Mark, I challenge you. No, I'm serious. This is all very true. But this is really cool. If we can get people, or if this game, Pokemon Go, gets people who are, whatever reason, housebound because of a mental illness, depression, agoraphobia, I mean, countless reasons, to make it a little less traumatizing and more appealing to open up that front door and go outside, walk around your block, go to the mall, wherever the case may be. Just please use common sense and don't get hurt. When Bloomberg was the mayor here of New York City, he was actually trying to ban and or impose high traffic tickets on people who were walking around the city and, you know, walking out into traffic, getting hurt, et cetera, and it got shot down. But, you know, this continues something like this. Man, I can see de Blasio and other cities following suit because, you know, it's kind of a crazy thing. Kid you not. It's Insight on Progressive Radio Network. My name's Mark Farrell. Thanks for sharing your day with me this and every week. I always love to hear what you have to say because you guys are so smart and creative. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. As I mentioned to you at the head of the show, Will Lackenauer. Great guy. In addition to being a great guy, he's a member of the U.S. Paralympic National Cycling Team. Yay! He was at the trials a couple weeks ago in North Carolina, did extremely well, and he's got a great story to tell us. Will, before his accident, he skied, water skied, climbed, and mountain biked competitively. And then on May 17th, 2008, Will's life changed dramatically. He suffered a spinal cord injury, otherwise known as a SCI, spinal cord injury, during a motocross race that resulted in complete paralysis below his chest. And I had a chance to speak to Will once or twice. And I have a very good judge of character. And I spoke with Will through a good friend of mine, Muffy Davis, who I want to thank for putting me in touch with Will. And I was going to have Will on for just a few minutes to talk about his excitement and his goal of obtaining a gold medal in Rio in September. But I said to Will, you know what? I got to have you on for a longer segment because you have a great story and you're a good guy. Will, welcome to the show. How are you, my friend?
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me. I'm really, really pleased to be here and get to spend a little morning time with your listeners, too. So thanks a lot.
Oh, you're so full of BS. You're tired. You're out in Nevada. You got one eye open and you're drinking coffee and you're just wishing this would get over with, right?
Actually, you know, this is good because my coach comes here in about an hour and we test like periodically every month. And, you know, testing sounds like, oh, you know, it doesn't sound too bad. Well, on the bike, testing is basically going as hard as you can till your eyes cross and then go a little bit harder. And I'm more worried about that coming up in the next hour than anything else.
Oh, good, so, good. So this is a nice little prelude to the whole, you know, like doing intervals. And we'll explain
exactly.
To people actually what you excel in. It's a hand crank cycle. It's incredible. It's got three wheels. It's low to the ground. And let me tell you something. You have to Google Will because the pictures of you, Will, flying, it's probably, I think, the closest thing to flying on the ground is in a hand crank cycle. I've tried it once or twice, and it's a really, really cool event.
Yeah, it's basically an adaptive bike, and it's driven by your hands, and it's in parallel. You don't have your hands opposed like a normal bike crank. You're basically doing it in parallel with a push-pull that you try to turn into as smooth a pedal stroke as possible, and you're basically reclined like you would be in a pool lounge, you know, type chair. So you're laying flat, and your head is kind of kicked up a little bit so you can see forward. And then your drive wheel is a single wheel in between your legs, and then there's two wheels out behind you. And my kids actually tease me. They tell me that I still ride a tricycle. And so they're on the big kid bikes now, but Dad still rides a tricycle. So
I imagine that go ahead, please.
It's a great piece. You know, when I was originally injured, this was one of the adaptive sports that I stuck my toe into, I guess, sort of. And it just spoke to me so quickly because it felt so similar to the able-bodied version.
Absolutely,
the
sure.
Tactics are the same, the training's the same, the aerobic, you know, ability and listen, cycling is a tougher sport. You know, you got to be willing to work really hard and there's got to be a part of you that enjoys that to excel at it. And so that was something that I just connected to early on.
And ladies, I have to tell you, Will is an Adonis. You should see this guy's physique, boy. Wow. Strong arms, big chest, looking very healthy. And of course, hey, you're modest. Let me brag about you, okay? That's my job. So the Rio 2016 Paralympic Games is pretty cool. It's expected, from what I've read, to be the largest to date, and in more than 4,500 athletes and 176 countries represented, which is very, very cool. So the number six has a little bit of a sour taste in your mouth, right, Will? Because of 6 seconds that kept you from going to London last time around. Tell us about that.
Well, it was as much, I think, with London, you know, I was actually a new injury, relatively at that point in time, and had come on to the domestic U.S. hand cycling scene. There was a very organized series that was out there, and there were some pretty established athletes that had been on the U.S. team and previous medal winners in the relay, and so breaking into that was perceived as next to impossible. And you know, like a lot of us, if somebody tells me something's next to impossible, that's just, you know, that's just food, you know, that just drives you. So, you know, I worked very diligently in training and equipment and everything to be able to compete at the top of the international level, and actually ended up winning the selection events for the team in 2012. And you know, basically, you know, the clock clicks and I was actually 30 seconds ahead of my next closest competitor in my injury classification. And so I was thinking I was going at that point. I mean, that's how it had been kind of portrayed to us. And, you know, unfortunately at the time, I think a lot of things, you know, kind of being a new injury, being new, there was certainly a question mark as a new athlete. Hey, is this guy going to deal with the pressure? Is he, you know, and come unglued and on the starting line or anything like that. And so I think they decided to go with an athlete that had proven themselves in the past. And that was disappointing for me. That was hard for my family too and my wife. I mean, it was not that far after I had been injured. And so it was kind of a kick in the teeth and, you know, but I still had the goal of making it to the Paralympics and I put my head down and continue to work forward for the games that's coming up in Rio. And you know, Mark, I'll be honest, it certainly served as a
motivating force.
It was. You know, not all motivating forces are good. And, you know, sometimes you just got to take something that's like a disappointment and didn't meet your expectations. And I did that. And at the same time, they made some changes within the team, too. There's a new director. They put a new selection process in place that's a little more, I'd say, objective in its requirements. And, you know, ultimately, it's, you know, you keep looking forward, you keep working forward. And I'm super proud to be representing the U.S. at the Paralympics this coming September.
Now, it seems to me like you're an incredibly optimistic person. But was there any time, Will, after you didn't get it onto the team to go to London that you said to yourself, you know, what am I doing here? I spent gargantuan, countless amount of hours training for this. Maybe I'm just being a little bit ridiculous with my goals here. Maybe I should just kind of, hey, keep this as an avid part of my life where I'm an avid cyclist and be the businessman and father and husband that I need to be instead of focusing this much time and effort on something greater.
Oh, definitely. I swear I probably talk to my wife once a month about it. And it's hard because there's soccer games I've missed and there's been an evening of homework help that I wish I had been able to give, but I was on my trainer or on my bike. I mean, make no mistake, there's no way to compete in the Paralympics and the level the athletes and the commitment the athletes are making without dedicating an amazing amount of time and resource, more than I probably anticipated. I think initially, and then you have to balance that with, I set this goal. I set this as a challenge. This is something I want to accomplish. And my kids have watched that too. So, you know, there's some lessons to be learned about, you know, sticking to something and working so you accomplish your goal. So there's been so many times where that's happened. And, you know, it's funny. I pull strength from my kids and not wanting to waste the time taken away from them when I get on that race course and making sure I deliver. And I pull strength from I have a men's cycling team, an able-bodied cycling team that I began riding with as a member last year, which is kind of unique. And it's funny, these guys are always like, oh, yeah, you know, Will, we get inspiration by watching you work so hard and you don't seem to, you know, being in a wheelchair doesn't seem to faze you. And the funny thing is the flip side is I pull tons of inspiration from them because they go to the start line and dedicate everything and put everything on the start line. And I respect that when people are willing to work and put everything into accomplishing their goal.
An athlete is an athlete.
Yeah. I mean, that was something, you know, after I was injured and, you know, it was something that, most of the people I've met, Mark, I'm sure you've found this too, you know, that I've met that have been injured in wheelchairs and I'm coming across, they weren't hurt on the couch. They didn't get injured watching TV. And, you know, they're active, vibrant people that had an unfortunate accident and turn around and go, okay, well, I loved competing before I was injured and it was a big part of my life. And now I'm going to have that be part of my life going forward. And,
The 17 or so other people on your team headed towards Rio, like yourself, are they self-funded or do you have sponsors or receive allocation from the governing body, IPC?
So the U.S. team has levels of support that they provide, and that's based on a point system that you earn throughout the year in international competition. And so there's some support there, but it's nowhere near what the athletes need to compete. And I believe me, I'm sure every year when I'm done at the end of the year, I look and what I put into this, and it's certainly not a net positive. But that's not why I'm doing this. You know, all of the athletes competing for the U.S. team on the on the para side, they have some sponsors, they have some family, they have some friends. I mean, it's a mixture of everything. I hope, you know, I see articles in CNN and I see people talking about, you know, the funds that you earn for a Paralympic medal versus the funds you might earn as an able-bodied medal. And I see that comparison drawn, and I'm not sure that's a good comparison to use. I think more importantly, I think what we need to do as athletes and within the para sports world is try to raise as much awareness and get as many eyeballs onto the competition, because that's what draws people in and that's what draws attention to it and ultimately will help draw funding to the sport. If you want to watch, I mean, hand cycling, sometimes I actually like will watch the race just because it is unbelievable. I mean, if you want to watch bicycling meets NASCAR, the bikes are more stable. There's much more contact. There's much closer racing. You're watching the Tour de France right now. You know, you watch two riders clip a wheel and, you know, they go down. You know, riders are jockeying for position in the corners, shoulder to shoulder on the hand cycles. And, you know, geez, when something does go wrong, there's nothing scarier than watching someone in a hand cycle and in a wheelchair spill out over the ground. I'm not saying that to be callous, but I mean, it's an incredibly exciting form of racing. And, you know, podiums are separated. I think I missed the bronze last year at a World Cup by 0.08 of a second in a time trial.
But you had a great year last year, correct?
I had a good year. I wouldn't call it a great year. I would call it a good year. I actually didn't finish as well in the World Championships as I hoped to. Well enough to score some points to make sure I got onto the team going to Rio, but certainly not where I would typically expect myself to finish. I think I finished seventh in the time trial. And it was a climber's course. I have all kinds of excuses, but you know, again, it just serves as motivation going into Rio.
Before your accident, before your accident, how familiar were you with the Paralympics, or if at all?
I would say none at all. Now, that's not true. From the winter side, I work in the winter sports industry, and there's a skier here, Ricky Kilgore, out of the arena. I was actually getting her skis. I didn't actually know her. I knew her coach. I donated some skis to some of the adaptive ski programs in town and at the local resorts. But that was about as far as my familiarity went. I mean, in the action sports world, ending up in a wheelchair, it can happen, just like it can happen in all kinds of walks of life. So I would say maybe semi-familiar from that standpoint. But from the Paralympics, no. From a spinal cord injury, my mom should be sainted, but my brother suffered a spinal cord injury when he was in college skiing and kind of miscalculated a section of the mountain and ended up hurting, you know, basically fracturing his spine, and he had an incomplete injury. And that was really where I learned about, you know, about spinal cord injuries. And but the Paralympics, no. It was really getting, I would say, Craig Hospital, where I ended up going for rehab, is where adaptive sport was really, really, truly introduced to me.
I want to read a passage, Will, that you had written so our listeners can get a great feel of what you experience at the moment. And this is a passage from Will Lackenauer. I couldn't have been out long. The blood from a small gash on my elbow hadn't even had time to travel down to my wrist. The sweet sun warm scent of crumpled sage marked where my body and bike had impacted. It was a warm, soft pillow against my cheek amidst a hard granite pile that had broken me. A constricting grip of immobility countered every effort to pick myself up. Each attempt to rise was met with an equal unseen opposing force. No, my legs weren't pointing where the mind's eye expected them to be, and I knew this was a spinal cord injury. Oh my God, I have a little girl. Fear of what would mean to taking care of my young family eclipsed any pain, piercing the haze of shock. Pretty powerful and poignant view there. And so that leads me to discuss what happened. You used to be a competitive motocross racer. Was this actually during a competition or a training episode when your accident took place? And explain exactly.
It was actually at a race. I think the week before Hangtown, which is a big race in California, at a local track here in the area I live. And you know, I remember it. It's visceral, but I remember feeling panic. I think for one of the first times in my life when that happened, I knew at that moment, like, everything was changing and at that moment, and that what did I just do to my kids and my family? And my wife was pregnant with our second, at the time. And, it was panic. I mean, I don't have any other word for it. And I knew I just needed to get to an x-ray machine as fast as possible and find out how much damage I had actually done. And, it was at that very moment, it marked a massive change in my life. And, they flew me to a trauma center, locally, and, you know, you're laying on the table in the trauma unit, and the surgeon came in with his notes in front of him, and he's kind of looking down, and I know he's coming in to tell me what's next. And, and, you know, he's kind of looking down at his charts, and he's like, well, we have a burst fracture at 9. We've lost, you know, 2 of your vertebra. 3 of them are essentially gone, but the problem is, you know, he's going through some of the injury, and I start asking him questions, and he kind of looks up from his charts for a second, and he's like, are you familiar with this injury? And I explained that my brother had suffered a spinal cord injury, and he looked at me, and he's like, do you want to see the x-rays? And then I said, I did. And he had them on his phone, and he kind of sat down on the table next to me, and, you know, he kind of held the screen in front of me and just said, you know, I've never seen anybody walk from this kind of injury again. He didn't say I wouldn't walk. He didn't try to pull that away. And, okay, you know, he was really direct. He's like, this is a really severe neurological injury, and we need to stabilize your spine because it's getting worse. As the swelling keeps climbing up your spinal column, your injury is just getting higher and higher. And I understood what he said, and I just, you know, I knew at that moment, you know, that this was that a wheelchair and my mobility and that was going to be what, you know, my immediate future looked like. And, you know, right at that moment, it was like, okay, well, how am I going to deal with this? And you also don't really realize what the change is going to look like at that time. You know, from an able-bodied ambulatory person, you know, that totally interacted with life physically, you know, your first thought is, oh my gosh, you're going to be in a wheelchair. And, you know, that's the thing you see in front of you when you see someone that's disabled or, you know, using a different form of mobility. You see their ambulatory state. You think that's what they're really dealing with. And it wasn't even until, you know, within the first year, I would say within, you know, a couple months at the rehab hospital that all the other issues that you deal with in a spinal cord injury became evident, and in some ways become even more challenging than the wheelchair.
And Will, when you mentioned, I'm sorry, when we spoke previously, you mentioned that you never went through the why me, which is a good thing.
No, it was, you know, I came out of surgery. My wife's pregnant. She's due in 2 months.
Wow.
We had made the decision. We have a 2-year-old at home that she's taken care of. You know, we had made the decision that she was going to take some time off of work and that we would be able to, you know, we wouldn't thrive, but we could survive on what I earned. You know, we could pay the mortgage and at least, you know, have this time where she could have the children. And, you know, it was our plan. And I was thrashing myself over, you know, throwing my leg over the dirt bike and still racing. I mean, I knew that was coming to an end, but I was just still holding on to it. And I was beating myself up for that at the time. And, you know, I went to Craig Hospital and had made the, you know, kind of personal decision. I was like, geez, you know, you need to, she wanted to come be there. And I was like, no, you know, Uma is 2 years old. You need to, you're pregnant. The last thing you need to do is be in a hospital situation with a baby
sure.
and one on the way. I mean, hospitals are, you know, they're not nice places to be. you know, and I was like, you need to go home and be home, and I'll do this, and I'll be back. I'll do the rehab. And, you know, in my mind at the time, I had no idea what we were in for. I really didn't. You know, I was kind of going through the mechanical steps, and there wasn't any time for why me.
And sometimes, you know, that's a good thing, not knowing what the future holds, you know, especially when you were going to be pretty much, for all intents and purposes, undergoing it alone.
Not alone, but, you know,
well, without your wife.
Responsibility. Hmm. Yeah, there was a responsibility to get the rehab done. I mean, I was fortunate. My brother was an outpatient at Craig, so I was familiar with this place. My mom was familiar with it. She, you know, she was ready to, you know, doesn't matter how old you are or how old your kids are. I know this now as a father, but your kids are always your kids. No matter where they are in their lives, you want to protect them. You want to be there for them no matter what. And my mom was driven to, you know, she's like, geez, I'm going to be there. I'll go to Craig. I'll, you know, help you as you make the transition while you're there. And I was like, no. I need you to go back home with Tanya, help with Uma, help, you know, make it as easy an environment as possible while we're going through this. You know, we've got a baby on the way. That needs to be healthy. That's the priority. And, you know, I'm just going to be doing the rehab thing. I'll figure it out. I think that was actually hard for Tanya in some ways because, you know, Craig is this amazing, amazing place where they help you get back to your life faster, but they also help the support and family around you because everyone goes through this at the same time.
Absolutely, sure.
You know, they're all connected to this. And, you know, Tanya had to go home and basically sit there and, you know, obviously she wasn't just sitting there. She's got a 2-year-old.
Hmm.
Anybody who has kids knows that, you know, what that brings.
Mayhem.
Yeah, and in the meantime,
control chaos.
You know, the
sure.
other half of, yeah, the other half is, you know, yeah. over in Colorado.
Hey, and, Will, quickly tell me the condition. You said your brother had an injury as well, but what kind of condition was he left in after his accident?
So he was in Colorado at the time in college when that happened, and he ended up with what's called an incomplete injury. He had some neurological diminished function in his left leg and some sensory in his left leg, but he was really lucky. They stabilized his spinal column, and he was an outpatient at Craig, and so he's an incomplete injury. He walks at this point.
Great.
And so he was very fortunate, and certainly I think in some ways I probably in the back of my mind I was like, well, Craig fixed him, you know, on my way there I'm thinking, well, maybe they'll fix me, you
absolutely
know? You know, like,
why not think like that, right?
But exactly. But, you know, when you get there, they're really, really, you know, they're all about, hey, this is your function. This is what you have right now. We're not saying this is where you're going to be. In fact, they tell you at the time, they're like, hey, your function could change, but we're going to deal with you as who you are at this moment. You know, what your ambulatory state is at this moment, because that's how we're going to get you back to your life as fast as possible. And for me, that's recovery. You know, I had to learn that. There's return, which is my function comes back. I get out of the chair. I dance with my wife again. I run. I move like I used to move. That's recovery. And we all hope for that. I hope for that all the time.
And it could still happen.
That's return. That's return of function. And we all hope for that. I would never not want that to happen. But recovery is, and that may or may not happen. That's a technological breakthrough. That's a miracle. That's whatever you want to say brings that about. But then there's recovery, and recovery is getting back to your life, smiling again, being a father, raising your children, running your business, taking enjoyment out of life that you got before you were injured.
Hmm.
That's recovery, and that's attainable for everybody.
Sure. And no matter what kind of experience you discover or experience in life, whether it was myself who I lost my brother to suicide, there's life before your brother, life after. Same thing, there's life before your accident, life post-accident. You know, you're different, but you have to adapt. You have to survive. You have to be resilient. And that's been certainly your mantra ever since the accident, correct?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, change meets people. You know, I have a visible change. You see me, I'm in a wheelchair. that change is visible. You know, every single person we walk by on the street, if you took a moment to talk to them, you'd probably find that they've suffered an incredible, you know, change in their life that turned their life in a different direction. Suicide, loss of a sibling, change of marital status, death of a spouse, loss of a child, change of your job, promotion, a degree that you've earned. You know, there's positive changes too, but these changes come in meet us. And it's really how you learn to, you know, I use three strategies. You know, there's an adapt to it. You kind of have to roll with it. You're not going to beat it. You basically have to incorporate it into your life. And there's a change where you comes to you and you stick your heels in. And you're like, I'm going to fight this. I'm going to bury this thing. It's not going to change me. I'm going to fight it. And there, you know, sometimes that's the right strategy. And the third is a combination of the two.
Sure.
And, you know, and you got to learn, I think, you know, you have to have some form of strategy when you are facing this kind of a profound change in your life to get through to the other side of it and shape it so that your life looks the way you want it to. That is something you can control. You can't control the change that happened, but you can control what your life looks like after it.
And who would have thought back in 2008, and here we are in 2015, that a local para-athlete who brought you a loaner hand crank cycle would ultimately change your life big time?
Oh, yeah. It's funny. It's, you know, I just come back from Craig Hospital, and I mean, I'm still in brace. I have no idea, you know, what I'm still learning. You know, every moment is just this new thing of learning. And there's a knock on my door, and wheel up to the front door, this guy out front there with a wheelchair, and he's another guy with crutches next to him, and it was John Kirsch and John Arnault, two local para athletes and total world class athletes actually in their own right. And he said, "Hey man, I'm really sorry you're in the club, and here's a hand cycle and get moving." And literally, and you know, they came
fantastic.
In and they
Please continue. Fantastic. Yep, sure.
No, they came in and they were great sources for, you know, basically here's a model of what you can do and how fast you can get back to your life, and certainly served as guides for me in the first, you know, first year or so. And,
at first, did you say
to
yourself,
got me started.
At first, did you say to yourself, this is crazy. I got injured riding motorcycles and all the other things that I did that which could have also injured me, but here I am now back with my family. My child is born now. Your second child is born, and here you are thinking, like, what am I going to do? Get back on the road?
Yeah, I think by that time, I think at Craig, I had worked through. I mean, I beat myself up so many times for causing this injury and change, putting my the well-being of my family, their revenue, lifestyle. I mean, everything in jeopardy, and. I'd beaten myself up so much. I think it was probably a couple months at Craig, and I had gone through the accident, I think for the 332,000th time, of how I could have changed something to not be in the chair. And I wasn't going to do it 3,333 times. It was like, how much energy am I going to burn?
Waste on that. Particular ideology,
trying
sure.
to change this. Yeah, I didn't have the bandwidth to keep doing it. I mean, I was barely clawing my way through all this, barely adapting to the change, and I had to stop. I couldn't beat myself up on that anymore. And you know, it's funny, Craig. They, you know, you're at this hospital where all these people have come with spinal cord injuries and brain injuries, and they all, you know. Talk to them. Well, how are you hurt? I was in a car accident. You talk to the next person. How are you hurt? I was in a car accident. You know, we all have our injury stories. And, you know, they give you the statistics, and walking out the front door and going to work in the morning, and certainly traveling, I was much more likely to be injured than I ever was racing dirt bikes, which is a very dangerous, you know, certainly carries its danger.
Extremely, sure.
But that wasn't the most dangerous thing I did every day. And being athletic, competing, you know, these are things my wife and I shared together. I mean, you know, we met our love of the Sierras and activities and water skiing together. I mean, you know, all, it was, these were all the things we did together. And, you know, that these activities are part of us. And I'm sure people that are passionate about their activities and their sports, this probably resonates with them. I mean, this is your identity. It's who you are.
Oh, absolutely. Through and through. Will Leckenauer is my guest. He's Rio bound. Yes, he's a Paralympian and headed to Rio in 8 weeks or so. And I have to say, he is a native New Yorker, right? Upstate New York?
I grew up in Rochester, New York, in Fairport, and then went to school in Pennsylvania in Pittsburgh, and then became a Western transplant after that.
Fantastic. All right, so 3 weeks into September, you're going to be at the opening ceremonies. I think your competition actually is a couple days later, 14th, 15th, and 16th, actually. How psyched are you, number one, to have made it to the Olympic Games? And then, obviously, you have to get over that excitement and then actually think about the actual events.
Well, it's funny. You know, you chase after this for 6 years to make a Games, and it's just that all-encompassing, you know, that's the goal. Okay, now I've hit first, you know, step one, you know, and now, okay, now the goal is to win. And, you know, the winning was never not in the background. That's my expectation when I go to the start line every time in anything I do. But I am so excited.
It's pretty obvious.
There is something about putting that kid on that says USA across the front of it and
absolutely
what it represents.
Sure.
And, you know, you actually, I was listening in the, you were opening, kind of talking about that, the face down in the cell phone, and we're so digitally connected right now. In your, you know, when you're talking earlier in your show, and this, the Olympics, I think one of the reasons people connect to it so much and why I love going to the international races is because it's not a digital connection. It's a personal connection. You know, the competition is visceral. It's personal. It's physical. It's not digital. And it's something that when people watch it, they can connect to it. And you get excited, so excited to see the competition, to see the pure sport of it, the pure competition. And you get to watch people put everything on the line for it.
It's so palpable.
Put everything.
The events I've seen, absolutely, Will, on every level. The events I've seen, I guess I started to be exposed about 95, 96. Wheelchair, mm-hmm, tennis, basketball, hockey, downhill skiing, hand crank cyclists. I mean, you name it, triathletes. It's just phenomenal.
Yep.
And I don't know what it is, because it's maybe the extra determination, extra will and courage for these athletes to be there. And the fact that they're given 1,000%, I've taken, you know, I've hired people to work with me because of camera crews and whatever. I mean, people walk out of there just, you know, overwhelmed with just positivity and incredulous of everything they have seen.
Yeah, if you want to watch something, I mean, if you're watching the headlines on the news and it saddens you and it upsets you, and turn on something from the Paralympics, turn on something from the Olympics. I mean, you want to talk about the best of humanity being shown. I mean, there isn't any better avenue than that.
You got that right.
I'm so excited to go, and you know, it is truly that personal competition and the relationships that are forged in it. I mean, make no mistake. The athletes from the other countries, we know each other. We know what we've raced each other a bunch of times at this point, and you know, you're coming there to represent your country, and you're going to put everything you can on that start line to deliver. And, there's a lot of sacrifice that's gone into it leading up to it. But at the same time, you know, the athletes wouldn't want it any other way.
Sure.
I mean,
absolutely.
I wouldn't, no. I can't wait to get to that starting line to win, to beat them.
And to podium, right?
Yeah. No, it's the expectation.
Exactly. Hey, Will, we're running short on time here, but I just want to get your input because I mentioned this also at the head of the show, where I'm a huge proponent of having the Paralympics first, precede the Olympics for many reasons. And also, I want your input on that, and also how the coverage, obviously, and again, we talked about the CR Day, is on NBC, and they stream it live in the middle of the hours, middle of the night when most of us are sleeping, how it would just be great, even if they did this as a test run or even made like a best of package. But because they're, and I understand it's cost, it's ratings, it's et cetera, but to for them to understand what a gargantuan opportunity that they're missing, they'll never really understand until they do something in this caliber.
I think so. I mean, I really, NBC, they're the ones who, they own the TV contracts at this point. They're the ones who are going to deliver or not deliver the content. And, you know, it's their responsibility for their viewers to put something in front of their viewers that's going to connect with them. But I would say if you want to watch an audience connect with people, you know, the time away from my kids is real. The sacrifice from the business, the time for the sport is real. It's authentic. And it was a huge part of the challenge to make it to the Paralympics. I have teammates that were servicemen in Iraq, in Afghanistan, that suffered terrible injuries serving their country, and that use sport as part of their recovery. I mean, you want to talk about athletes that have dedicated themselves to this country on so many levels. This is an amazing opportunity for NBC to showcase some of these stories, and it's just about getting this in front of the American people and the audience to see it. Having the Paralympics in front of just before as a precursor to the Olympics, I think would be awesome.
Absolutely.
I think it would be great.
And Will, I'd like to end on one of your another poignant saying that you've had. Once we learn how to manage change in our lives, fear fades and we are all able to shape our future. Very well said, and so true, my friend. Will?
It is. Thank you.
I wish you nothing but good luck, and I hope you see a square box and you're able to get on the very top of that one, because that means you reach your gold status. And please keep in touch, my friend. We want to hear about this. Keep in touch as you lead up there and get to Rio, and also when you get back, and we'll talk about all your successes.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me this morning. I really appreciate it.
Will Lackenauer, Paralympic hand cyclist, headed to Rio. Have a good time, my friend. Good luck.
Thank you. I'll do my best.
And I want to say that we lost a great radio legend, unfortunately, over the weekend. Vaughn Hopper on WBLS, The Quiet Storm, for many, many years. Nicknamed the Kangaroo Kid. He was 6'4", played basketball, incredible athlete. Was drafted, actually, by Detroit Pistons, but actually never played. He was on BOS until 2008. An incredible, incredible master of his craft. My name is Mark Prowl. The show has been Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great day.